Good afternoon. Welcome to today's session on behavioral genetics. My name is Adil Monk, and I have the distinct pleasure of introducing you to Dr. John Loike. Dr. Loike serves as co-director of graduate studies in the Department of Physiology at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and is the director of special projects in Columbia University Center for Bioethics. As well, Dr. Loike directs the Thailand-based summer internship program called Cross-Cultural Educational Programs. Through his research, we have gained a tremendous amount of information pertaining to immunotherapy of cancer and infections. He has over 100 publications in major scientific and bioethical journals and has co-authored several books. It is an honor and privilege to have Dr. Loike speak with us today. I kindly ask that all cell phones be turned off, and you now direct your attention to Dr. Loike. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Well, you know, I felt great. First of all, I want to thank the organizer, especially Eddie Reckman, for inviting me to speak. I want to begin by saying something that is probably obvious to you, but you probably won't hear this too often. And that is that when you think about the impact of the Torah on the world, everybody will recognize that we've given the world a real ethical foundation, and the world's picked up on that. But few people outside of this room would ever appreciate is that we, in terms of the Torah community, has given the world the real foundations of bioethics and medical ethics. In my travels across the globe and in programs in Thailand and England and Paris, it's clear to me as I hear all these different religious thinkers and scientific thinkers speak about bioethics that really they've taken our foundations. And it's a real Kiddush Hashem that we're able to do this, and conferences like this will only perpetuate that type of endeavors. So call it about to the Torah and to why you're doing this. What I want to do today is really, first of all, before we discuss the cases that I've presented to you, I want to bring you all up to par, give you a sort of different perspective of my view of genetics and the halakhic perspectives. And I want to begin by sort of characterizing to you what I call three categories of genetics and genetic disorders. And the first category is what you heard about this morning so beautifully presented, and those are genetic mutations or defects that result in diseases like K-cell cystic fibrosis. They follow what's called the Mendelian genetic pattern. It's very clear that if a couple are both carriers, that for K-cell, 25% of their children are going to be affected with the disease. It's very clear to predict that for K-cell, for cystic fibrosis, for Huntington's disease, in which if one of the partners of a couple has the gene, then 50% of the children are going to come down with Huntington's disease. That's the first category. The second category involves those type of genetic variations or mutations that increase your risk to certain diseases. And again, you heard a lot about this in terms of cancer. There's a lot of genes that if you have these genetic mutations, you have an increased risk of getting cancer in your lifetime. Now, if I would ask you, what is the difference between these two categories? Why in the second category can't we make the same predictive accuracy of the incidence of a child getting the disease? What would you say? What are the factors that make, in the first category, K-sex very accurate predictability? In the second case, there's always an association of increased risk. What would you say? Anybody? Yes?
The second category has certain environmental or epigenetic elements.
Very good. So he said two things. The first thing he said was epigenetics, or really said environmental, the other one was other genetic parameters. Let's discuss the second case. The second issue is the fact that our lack of predictability is based on the fact that a lot of these diseases, whether they be Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, cancer, are multi-genetic. They require a lot of genes, and we just don't know how all of these genes play a role. And once we establish and identify all these genes, let's say in 50, 100 years, we'll increase our ability to predict whether a certain individual will come down with one of these diseases. And these epigenetic factors, this is very new and very exciting. For those of you who remember basic biology, you learned about Lamarckian genetics. Do you remember that? Lamarckian genetics was saying that your environment, how you responded to your environment, had a genetic effect, and that impacted future generations, and that was put to shame by Darwin, and it was just denied. Turns out Lamarckian was a lot smarter than we thought, and it's becoming clearer and clearer that environment and not only impacts your own life, but also can impact the genetics of your children. And that's what we call epigenetic factors. And that's because it's going to become a very important role in understanding the development of these diseases. And again, I highlight to you the fact that when I was taking graduate studies in molecular biology, we used to call the 95% of the genome, which does not code for any genes, what that was called junk DNA. Well, as you all know, cholesterol is not great junk. And it's becoming clearer and clearer that this DNA is very important in regulating the expression of all of these genes. So that's the first element. And the second element that he pointed out is environment. And this is incredibly important, and it's going to be even more important. Now, even in those category one, cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs, can you think of a disease in which you have a genetic predictability of 100% and in which environment can prevent that disease from taking place? Can anybody think of an example? Where's the medical students? Come on. Anybody?
PKU.
Very good. PKU. So you want to tell me what PKU is?
I don't remember the answer, but the body
right. This is a genetic disease. They can't break down phenylalanine, and if it's untreated, these kids develop severe mental retardation, seizures, a whole host of diseases. And it's very easily treatable. Just put them on a low diet of phenylalanine, and they grow up to be perfectly normal. That's a rare exception where you see how environment can impact the expression of the disease. I will tell you, it's not really been published, but it's called people who are experts. You could even get some delay in Huntington's and the development of Huntington's disease. Huntington's disease, as some of you may know, is a genetic disease, incredible predictability. Not only can I predict which individuals are going to come down with the disease, but depending on the number of copies of a certain repeat of DNA, I can tell you at what age the person is going to come down with the disease and pretty much when he's going to die from the disease. It's almost Calvinistic in how you can predict this. And people for the last 20 years have thought there's no way to treat this disease, especially not with medication as yet and environment. And yet in the last 2 years, we've realized that certain lifestyles, certain diets can delay the onset of this disease. So these are a few exceptions to the first category where environment can play a role. Now, in terms of the second category, there are many more examples where environment can play a critical role in the development of diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, cancer, etc. And I think that the more you think about it, you realize that no matter how much we learn about the genetics, the role in environment is going to play a very important role. For example, you have diet. All right? All of you know that diet has a tremendous impact. Now, I can say this here, I couldn't say this at Columbia, they shoot me down. But I'll tell you, one of the best books, sources of a diet book, happens to be the Torah. And the Chef Aminion, if you think about them from a scientific perspective, offers an incredible insight in a really healthy diet. If you look at the various agents, red grapes have a lot of antioxidants. It's great against inflammatory disease, atherosclerosis, cancer prevention, resveratrol, which is anti-aging, incredible. Dates have a real role in muscle development, athleticism, and prevention of abdominal cancers. It's a great fruit to suppress hunger. Figs, anti-cholesterol, it lowers cholesterol. Blood pressure, pomegranates, tremendous source for antioxidants and seems to impact development. The Alzheimer's disease, Alboil, I mean, I say you all know about the richness of vitamin E, and all of these things are very important. What's interesting is that there's a Huss and Sofer, which I saw last week, which was really fascinating. They asked the Huss and Sofer, why is it that there's a discrepancy between medical knowledge in his time, in the 17th century, and what the law said? Why isn't there an agreement? So he cautiously answered and said, because a lot of these studies were done on Boyan, in which they didn't keep a kosher diet. And if you do the studies on people who maintain a kosher diet, you might get a different result. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a remarkable insight from a Gadol HaDor. All right, so we see the importance of diet and environmental factors. And I want to also highlight to you something very important. When you think about environment and how does it really impact a disease, you got to think of the immune system. I'm an immunologist. I'm very biased by this. And whatever you think about, and I can tell you from our own research in cancer, that we understand that certain cancers, the ability of your immune system to eradicate the cancer is at the cost. And we're working with like melanoma, and we've discovered that really the tendency to get or to die from melanoma or to be cured from melanoma depends on your immune system. And we know that diet, lifestyle, exercise all can improve your immune system, and that can really impact your development. And I have to point out to you something that is very important as of this morning. You heard about risks of cancer. Judith Goldman, a very famous physician at Harvard, did a remarkable study in the 80s. What he did is that he took autopsies of individuals over the age of 80 who died of heart attacks. That's it, no history of cancer. And as he looked at the autopsies, he found a lot of mini tumors all over the place, in the prostate and the breast. And when you think about early diagnosis of cancer, and early diagnosis, either genetically and such, we have to be a little bit cautious. We now are accumulating more and more information that sometimes, not a lot, but sometimes a person will present with looks like a lung cancer, get delayed, come back 6 months later, and it's disappeared. Same thing with breast, prostate, and on. And why? Because intrinsically, your immune system has the capacity to eradicate a tumor. If the tumor becomes a little bit too large, becomes vascularized, then you're in trouble. But up until that point, you have the capacity. And how you create your environment by diet and lifestyle can really impact on your ability to deal with these diseases. Now, the third category is what we're here for, and that is those genes that affect behavior, whether it be athleticism, sexual preference, violence. There are a lot of evidence, as you heard Rob Tellman speak about, where genes can affect that. And I want to give you a few examples of real specific cases. For example, does everybody know about the adultery gene? We're going to talk about shidduchim, and I know it's not part of Doris Shurim, but there are genetic tests for $99 that can assess whether you have a propensity to commit adultery. How did that develop? It developed scientifically from studies where they were looking at prairie dogs. There are two species of prairie dogs. One species that's highly monogamous and will only mate with one partner for the whole life, and the other species that will mate with anything on four legs. And they found one gene, and they could transplant that gene from the polygamous prairie dog into the monogamous species, and guess what? It became highly polygamous. So this one gene transformed the whole behavior, and this company, Genetic BioLabs in Colorado, they isolated a human equivalent, and they offer to you, anybody who wants, for $99 to test this. Now, in human beings, what is the evidence for a genetic predisposition? Well, it's clear there is a family history. If you look at twins, and they've looked over 1,600 twins in the United States, and interviewed the interviewed the women and the sexual partners, they found there's a clear genetic predisposition, hereditary predisposition to being unfaithful. And interestingly enough, they then looked, we know in animals, that if you take, there's a whole series of genes called major histocompatibility complex genes. These genes you are familiar about because they're important in assessing whether a person is a good recipient for an organ transplant. These are the genes that make your immune system different than your brother, your father, your mother, a friend. These are the genes that tell your body to recognize self versus foreign. And there are a whole variety of alleles of these major histocompatibility genes. And they did a study, and they know in mice and in birds, that there's a preference, a mating preference, for those partners who have different histocompatibility alleles. So the more different these alleles are, the more likely they're going to mate, and et cetera. And when they did the same study in human beings, they looked at couples, they measured their histocompatibility likeness or dislikeness, and they found an amazing thing, that in those couples where they had very similar major histocompatibility alleles, guess what? There's a tremendous increase in the likelihood of the female to commit adultery and to not be satisfied with a male partner. And in contrast, under those situations where there were a very dissimilar, then they're more likely to be faithful to each other. So that's the second evidence that genes can play a role. And now, in this case, you have where you have one or two genes that really play a role. As in other situations, there are a lot of situations where the behavior is multi-genetic. Intelligence involves probably scores of genes. We know in the mice, we've already identified 33 genes that we can alter to enhance the learning capacity of these mice. And that's going to be true. I think that's really a paradigm for a lot of behavioral things. And another example, of course, is when you think about other types of behavior. When you look at, you can read the literature about sexual preference, homosexuality. Is there a genetic component to that? Probably there is. There are clearly, talk to any good psychiatrist, some of which are in the audience, that yeah, there are certain individuals who no matter, we don't even know how to treat them because of the genetic position. Probably a small minority, but it's true. Aggressive behavior, absolutely true. We know that there is a predisposition. So I think what's really important out of this is to realize that environment plays a much more dominant role in behavioral genetics than it does in disease, other types of disease types of genetics. That's the take-home lesson. Now, let's discuss a little bit about the halakhic parameters related to this thing. And a lot, what I'm going to say, I say with in learning with Rabbi Tendler, and if I make a mistake, it's my fault. So I apologize in the beginning. But what I want to do in discussing the halakhic parameters is give you a case. It's 10 years ago, 1997, okay? A couple, they've been dating for 6 months, and they're ready to consider getting engaged. They go to Dori Shurim, and it comes back. This is a no-show. This is not a match made in heaven. Namely, there's a genetic incompatibility. They get it tested, and of course, they both turn out to be carriers for Tay Sachs. What are their options 10 years ago? Anybody? One option.
Break up.
And in fact, 10 years ago, if you would have asked a lot of her baby, they would have said, you don't have to marry this person. You can break up. Don't marry this individual. What's another option?
PGD.
What? No, 10 years ago. No. What?
Play their odds.
Well, they could get married and do one of three things. Either not have children, which is, of course, not within the halakhic paradigm of options. They could get married and undergo genetic testing to ensure they have healthy children. And at that time, they had, as you heard this morning, they had only two options. They could either go to CVS, chorionicle assembly, which is done really at that time after 10 weeks, or they could do amniocentesis, which is done usually after 12 weeks. And if the child that they are carrying is, of course, affected, then they can opt for termination of the pregnancy. And again, as you heard this morning, this creates a real halachic problem, because most poskim will hold that to terminate a pregnancy after 40 days really presents halachic problems. And only, as far as I know, there's the Tzitz Eliezer that you heard about, who allows this after three months. And I've heard, although not directly, that even Rav David Cohen in Brooklyn at times today will allow termination of a pregnancy after 40 days, maybe even after 3 months. But that was a viable option. And then, of course, there's another option. They could let Shomer Patayim Hashem, let fate take its course. And you heard a little bit about this from Rabbi Willie this morning. I just want to add a couple of more points to that. And I think if you look at the Gemara, the examples that the Gemara cite about this Midah and Nevoah Zarah, it's clear that the Tosfos Rid derives a very important insight into the state of Shemor Patayim Hashem. What he says basically is that this works only when there's a very small risk of a danger, not when there's a significant risk of a danger. And secondly, Rav Hirsch and Truma Sedeshin go beyond that to say that the principle of Shomer Patayim Hashem does not apply to an educated individual. If you understand the risks, if you understand what's involved, this principle doesn't apply. It always reminds me of the story of the Gemara that I think it's Kimchas, right? Kimchas was Zocha to have seven children, some sons, who all became Kohen Gadol. And they asked, why were you Zocha to this? And she said, because the walls of my house never saw my hair uncovered. And the Yerushalmi on that says that many people have tried this and have failed. It doesn't necessarily mean it works. And it reminds me of this because I think that the idea of saying, okay, I'm going to rely on Kadosh Baruch Hu, we know statistically there are a lot of families who have great emunah who have not undergone testing, who are both carriers, and 25% of their children have been affected. So one has to be very careful, and I think accepting, you know, what Rav Hirsch says and the Truma Sedeshin, that this idea of Shemar Patayim Hashem really should not apply in this situation, especially since we have options. So now, let's go to the present case. Now we have the same couple today, same result. What other options do they have today to ensure that they have to have a healthy family? So again, you heard two options. One is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, okay? I should tell you, from speaking to the expert at Columbia, it's a very, very safe procedure. Despite what you're going to read about on the internet, it's very clear that the incidence of birth defects, the danger to the women today is much, much less. And there have been thousands of babies born with PGD who are perfectly healthy and no impact even on the mother. Now, that is not to say that a woman should undergo several rounds. In order to do this, they really discuss it. Let me just give you a brief background how to do this. What is done here is you have to hormonally stimulate the woman to isolate mature oocytes, mature eggs. And then they take out these eggs, they put them in a petri dish, they take sperm, and they fertilize them. You have 10 or 20 fertilized eggs. You then screen each one to determine which one of them is an affected Pesach, which one are carriers, and the statistics usually are pretty good. 25% are going to be unaffected, 50% are going to be carriers, and 25% are going to be affected. So you have really good statistics. They implant one or two. No longer is the need to implant three or four or five. If you do it in a good place like in Israel, which is probably one of the best places in the world, they have a tremendous success rate implanting one or two of these fertilized eggs and having healthy children. In New York, the main centers, and this is very important, and I shouldn't say this publicly, but it's really true, where you go makes a big difference. If you're going to New York, Columbia, Cornell, NYU are the three places to go. Now, Today, there's another option. A couple of physicians, one in New Jersey, one in California, who will engage in chorionic villus sampling at 30 days after pregnancy, after fertilization. 30 days. Now, I haven't seen the clinical data, but from speaking to people who've done this, it seems to be the way they've developed it, it's very safe. So now they can determine whether this fetus is an affected fetus or not before the 40-day limit. And as you all heard about this morning, the 40-day gestational time point is a very important point. Because if it's before 40 days, many more rabbanim would allow the termination of a pregnancy if they're carrying a Tay-Sachs or an affected child. So these are two options that are available today which were not available beforehand. Now, you heard this morning a number of things which, again, I'll repeat briefly. One is the recognition that halacha really values the use of these interventions. It's not trivial. And each one of these interventions, you have to work with a rod on a case-by-case basis. But in principle, using PGD to have healthy babies is mutar. What do you do with the extra embryos? That's not so clear. It's not so clear that you should take these embryos and just discard them. It'd probably be a lot better to donate them for research, and if they're, especially if they're unaffected. If they're affected, they're affected embryos or pre-embryos, then you could probably, it's more likely you could discard them without. Now, what also is very important is that the Gemara in Yevamos and others, other halakhot, says that it's a person should not marry into a family of lepers or epileptics. And Rashi expands upon this category to include any hereditary disease. There is an imperative that we, as Rav Tevel would say, we have to create health families with healthy children. Whatever we can do to create healthy children who are not diseased, that's very important. And that's a very important principle to take into consideration when you're dealing with these things. The other principle is to recognize that halakha values infertility as a legitimate condition. And the Nitziv says explicitly that from the whole parsha of Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Chana being infertile, and saying, you know, when Rachel says to Yaakov, give me children or else I'd rather die, the Nitziv clearly says that infertility can be viewed as a critical disease. These are very, very progressive statements that have to be incorporated. So what about enhancing fertility? There's no problem producing healthy children. No problem halakhically. What about using the same technologies, right, for behavioral enhancement? And this becomes a real, really important issue. And so we have the case that you all have read about. Let's discuss the Delbert case. Here you have a couple, right? And one is about tshuva, comes from a history where the parents had a number of adulterous affairs. Can they engage in testing halakhically to see whether this person has the gene for adultery? What do you think about that? Do you think it would be allowed? And why? If yes, support it. If not, not. You're saying the knowledge that knowing that you have a certain genetic predispositions may help you in overcoming that. Anybody else? Yeah. I mean, you raise two issues. One is testing, the other is selecting, right? clearly testing is not as dangerous, and one could present an argument. One could present the other side of the argument too, say, if I know I have this genetic predisposition for adultery, I can't do anything about it. It's not me. So, you know, it may not necessarily lead to tshuva. So there are both sides of it, but that's a very different type of philosophy than saying we're going to genetically correct this. Can we select embryos that don't have this gene? As a matter of fact, I will tell you something. There are now, there's recent evidence, there are genes for Frumkeit. Exactly, spirituality. We know that there, you can give an individual a psychological assessment for spirituality, and you can associate that with certain genes that regulate neurotransmission. So not only could you test for adultery, but if you want to have a really right-wing, you know, spouse and children, you can test for spirituality as well. So there's a lot of things, and what it does really is, I think that the problem with this is that in doing so, when you start selecting for these things, you're removing a primary responsibility of the parents, and that is the education of the children. And when you think about this, when you really think about this, you say, this really environment, does it really, really, can it really impact behavior? And I'm going to present to you a very fascinating experiment that was done with mice. There are two species of mice that we work in the lab. One is called BALB-C, and the other is called C57s. BALB-C mice are extremely docile. They're the most gentlest animals you've ever seen. You have to kill them for an experiment, they'll walk right up to the guillotine or to the, you know, ether, and they'll just say, oh, take me, you know, I'm ready to go. Sacrifice myself for science. The C57s are extremely aggressive. I mean, I have to wear thick gloves to even capture them because they will bite and they will fight, and it really takes a lot to get them. So they did the following experiment. They took newborn pups of the C57 violent, and they put them in the cage of the docile BALB-C and let the docile BALB-C mice raise them for a few weeks. Did it change the behavior? Absolutely not. The behavior was the same. The C57 pups grew up to be very aggressive and violent, and the reverse, of course, the docile BALB-C, when they were put in the cages raised by the C57, grew up very docile. Not surprising. But then they did the following experiment. They took fertilized eggs from the C57 and they transplanted them into the BALB-C mice, pseudopregnant BALB-C mice. So the BALB-C mice gestated these C57 pups and vice versa. And guess what happened? The genetic C57 pups that grew up were gestated in the BALB-C mice were born docile. And those pups that were from genetically the aggressive C57 mice that were gestated in the docile, they grew up docile, and the docile ones that grew up in the C57 aggressive were born and they were aggressive. That's a profound, profound statement showing how environment can alter a complex behavior such as aggression. Not only that, but it maybe offers an insight into parenthood and surrogate parenthood. We all have the issue. If somebody serves as a surrogate parent, right? A woman never cannot carry a child, okay? So they hire a woman to be a surrogate parent. And there's a whole halakhic debate whether do you go by the genetic mother, do you go by the surrogate mother, the birthing mother. It's a tremendous debate. Both sides have valid arguments. Rav Shlomo Zalman says that he's never heard of, he doesn't know of a precedent for this. You have to go lechumah to both sides, so you have to take both into consideration. But I think that this mouse study provides a certain insight. Talk to any pregnant woman who's had many children, and they will tell you that they feel sometimes that the personality of the child that they had was in part dependent on what occurred during the pregnancy. And what it's saying is that pregnancy is not, they're not just an artificial incubator. They impact on the behavior and the personality of the child. And we know that if you adopt a child and you teach a child, that child has to give this adoptive parents kavod. We know that a rav has certain common elements of kibbutz because the rav is teaching the child. So every time you have a situation where a person can input into the personality, there is this issue of parenting. I think that's a very important lesson. So basically, what I want to conclude is the following. That when you talk about behavioral genetics, I think we have to differentiate between testing and selection. I think selection, we shouldn't engage in. I think it's inappropriate. We might in the future find situations where you have an individual who has a history of aggression, who we know that if you correct the gene, you can, you know, really stop this. You might be doing gene therapy, or maybe under those extreme circumstances, probably very rare, you can select. But that's probably the exception. In most situations, there's so many multiple factors that come into play here that it's inappropriate to do selection. But diagnosis, again, depends on the personality. If you think that you could benefit out of this, call a kavod. But if you can't, what are you going to get? And the second thing is to really understand how important the environment is. And I leave you with a wonderful Ramban. The Ramban embraces on Ramini Urav, and Hashem says, look at mankind, Ramini Urav. They're evil from birth, from their youth. The Ramban says an amazing insight. What he says is as follows. That really, you look at babies. Babies are born egocentric. They only care about themselves. That's the Ra Minyura. Ra, it comes from egocentricity, selfishness. How do you give them Yetra Tov, which some enforcers say in Midrash says comes at either age 13 or Baldas or 18. How do you do that? The Ramban says, by teaching them Chesed. By teaching them how to be receptive to the needs of other people, you compensate this Ra Minyurav and make them into a tzaddik. And I think that's the lesson of behavioral genetics. We have to appreciate how important our education, our peers, our parents can play a role in behavior. And we really can make an impact. And in that case, we don't have to worry so much about our genetic predisposition to behavior. We all have defects, as we heard this morning. But we have that potential, that power to change that. I think that is really the lesson of behavioral genetics. I'm open for some questions. Yes. Oh, we know genetically there are different genes, yeah, with the C57s of ALPC. Absolutely, that regular. Oh, were there any changes in the genes? Oh, very good question. I don't know the answer, but I'll tell you something else which is fascinating, which you'll probably not hear, or maybe some of you know. How should I phrase this? Okay. Women who are pregnant, fetal cells escape, stem cells from the fetus, escape from the fetus and implant in the brain and the muscle of the mother. For reasons which I can't understand immunologically, not only do they implant there, millions of them grow and they stay for the lifetime of the mother. It's clearly scientific proven. And now we know the opposite. We know that maternal fetal stem cells transverse the placenta and implant into the fetus. What the impact of these transplanted cells, as you can all imagine, Kadosh Baruch Hu never does something without a reason. I don't know, but take that into consideration on how it may affect the genetics. Yes?
In my experiment, yes. Are you extrapolating environment? Because the environment you're talking about, change in environment, is an in utero environment.
Exactly.
Are you extrapolating that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Is there evidence for that?
No. It's a very difficult study to do, but I am. Yes. Thank you for pointing that out.
Was there a difference in how the mother mites treated the their own, not their own adopted in utero?
Not evident to the observer.
Okay.
Not that it was reported in the paper. No. Yes?
I feel like there's an underlying error in the premise of that study, being that it's certainly factually true that some mice were domiciled and some mice were aggressive. When we apply it to ethics and morality, domicile or aggressive is not necessarily, one is not necessarily better than the other.
Nobody says it's better. It's a different behavioral characteristic. Some people are gentle, some are aggressive, some are violent, some are less violent. Nothing to do with a statement on what's right or what's wrong, which is a statement on their genetic behavioral characteristics.
Right, but when choosing for preferences or assuming that one is better than the other, we can't really make that assumption.
Well, it depends how you define violence, right? I mean, if you come from a history of a family where your parents abused you and their parents abused them, right, you wouldn't necessarily want to have a child that would abuse their children.
It's true, but let's talk about something like hyperactivity. So
that's a different...
People might not want to select for that, but it might be beneficial.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, we all know the Class B college student. Don't we? You know the story? And at least when I was going to school, we had the Class A student who was, like myself, very bright and, you know, very successful professionally and didn't make a lot of money. And then there was the Class B student who ended up working and made a lot of money and said, what happened here? So sometimes intelligence is good and sometimes it's not so good. Same thing with aggression. All these things, it depends. It's not a black or white issue. I agree with you. But I think that the overall message is not to identify what's good or what fits, personality, what you want to, you know, what you value. But that's okay. Yes?
So I conclude when you said that the disposition of the pregnant mother affects the embryo.
Yes.
I wonder if you could make this point, you could make a study of those mothers pregnant in the last year during the terrible stress. You don't have
you want to support it?
No.
If you support it, we can do it.
But I have another point.
Yes.
Everyone has been laughing for years that if a pregnant mother listened to Mozart, it would calm the embryo. Could this be possible?
I could be. Let me tell you something. Oliver Sacks spoke at Columbia, and he said something remarkable, which really shook us all up. About music. We all believe, as Kabbalah, that music is sort of the food of the soul, right, of the neshama. And there may be a lot of truth. We don't appreciate the impact of the centers of the brain that are involved in music. So he told us the amazing story that he had patients who had severe Parkinson, trembling uncontrollably, who used to be pianists, concert pianists, and he put them down by a piano and put their hands to the keyboard, and all of a sudden, they could play a whole sonata or a concert without any trembling. The centers of the brain that are involved in music, which we don't understand the mechanisms yet, impact memory. He had this for Alzheimer's patients who couldn't remember anything, and yet he played music in terms of an opera they used to sing. They started singing, they couldn't even speak. I mean, on and on and on. So these centers of the brain, which are involved in music, impact the whole region in pathways that we have yet to identify. So that's a very good point.
About the known fact that people who stutter and are public speakers, there's no problem. I have a friend who was around 25 years, never stuttered once when he spoke.
True.
So that's not music, but that's what that would be.
Right. The brain is a wonderful organ.
We'll take one more question.
Okay. Yes. Education. Let me tell you something. I was in Thailand this past summer, and there was a student from the United Arab Emirates who was educated there, and she started asking all these questions about Israel. Don't you view the Israelis as engaging in a Holocaust? I mean, very intelligent woman. And she would go on and on and on, asking us these obvious attached to this. And you, Aaron also, you'll realize that all of this was because of her education, what she was told. And then when I would ask her a question, like I asked her, I said, well, it's very nice, but Islam is a very moderate religion. How do you explain all the killing between the Shiites and the Sunnis? She says, what killings? And then I would say, do you know that you can come to any church, any synagogue that you want to, and I can't go on the Temple Mount to come to the Mosque of Omar? She says, I didn't know that. So education has a tremendous impact on how you behave.
More like medically speaking.
How it does it?
I'm saying you're positive that that an in vitro environment
right
is gonna affect
have
the
an
way
impact. Yes.
I'm positive. And so I'm assuming that that would have an effect on disease and
I think so. I but
do
a lot more
stuff.
Research.
So
yeah.
I think that the country, a whole country that was being, you know, like bombed by terrorists and it's under terror.
Oh, that side.
Yeah, that side of it.
Oh,
would
yes.
you have a spike when you see like a population?
Interesting. I don't know the answer yet. That's a good question. I don't know the answer.
Like, and the Holocaust
right.
survivors, would you see like a
maybe education is the answer to that.
Maybe. All right. Thank you very much.